You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we are in London.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Evening.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Lionel, where are we?
We are outside the Westminster Arms Public House, enjoying a post-stage beer, just along from the press centre, which is in Central Hall, Westminster. A just short hop across the park from where the stage finished this afternoon. There's a lot of people out having a drink, I suspect, have been to watch the race, perhaps knocked off an hour early to go and see the race. Crowds were absolutely huge. It was like the Olympics all over again, wasn't it?
It was all the way. I think there were a lot of fears that today, Monday's stage, would be slightly anticlimactic after those two phenomenal days in Yorkshire, where the official viewing figures are now more than the population of Great Britain. I think we're saying that 80 million people turned out over the 2 days to watch the Tour de France. And by tomorrow it might be 100. No, today again was wonderful. Cambridge was packed with people. We had the luxury, some of us, of sleeping in our own beds last night. And I actually saw the start of the stage on TV. And often, you know, it's an old trope that the start of the stage is often the most exciting part. You see quite aggressive racing, lots of attacking. That wasn't the case at all today. Two riders slipped off. I can't even remember who they were. Daniel, do you remember who the échappés were?
Jan Bartha and Jan the fella from Bretagne Seche.
B-Day,
correct.
B-Day again. Yep. And but there was no. They were just allowed to go clear. And it was almost as though Sunday's stage was such a hard stage, took a lot out of people, that there was almost a sort of a truce called. They fell quite a bit behind schedule, and then obviously coming into London, the rain started to fall. It was a fairly sort of controlled affair. Marcel Kittel won the second stage of this tour after winning Harrogate on Saturday. It was a very straightforward victory for him. And I was just commenting to you guys earlier that we seem in the blink of an eye to have gone from talking of this golden age of sprinting where Kittel, Cavendish, who's obviously missing with his separated shoulder after crashing on Saturday, and Andre Greipel were all quite evenly matched. Greipel's been nowhere so far in this tour. His team weren't very present today. And Kittel looks so dominant that these sprints are in danger of being slightly predictable and boring even.
Well, yeah, I spoke to John Degenkolb, who's performing lead-out duties for Marcel Kittel in the Giant Shimano team, and my last question to him was, who now are your main rivals now that Cavendish has gone home? And he basically shrugged and didn't really give any kind of answer, because when you look at the start sheet now, there isn't a great deal of credible opposition to Kittel on the flat stages, and we could be witnessing this year Kittel's equivalent of Mark Cavendish's 2008-2009, when we won four stages, six stages, five stages the year after that. If you look at the flat stages that are to come in just in the first week, there's plenty of opportunities, and assuming Kittel gets through the mountains, you know, he could be six, seven stage wins by the end.
That's a big assumption though, isn't it, Lionel, that he's going to get through the mountains? I mean, I wrote a feature recently for Pro Cycling Magazine about Kenny Van Hummel, a former infamous Lanterne Rouge in the Tour de France. And Kenny Van Hummel got a reputation in the 2009 Tour de France, or he was labelled the worst climber in the history of the Tour de France by Jean-François Pecheur, who was the competitions manager at the Tour at the time. And in this feature, I talked about who, in actual fact, is the worst climber in professional cycling. And a fair few people put Marcel Kittel's name forward, so I think he will really, really struggle, especially, you know, you look at the steep climbs we've got ahead in the Vosges, we've got the Alps. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he doesn't make it to Paris.
He made it last year, but do you think this year's course is more loaded against him because of those, particularly the steep climbs?
Yeah, I would say so. It was, to be honest, it was a bit of a mystery to me how he did make it through last year's tour.
It's shorter stages tend to be harder as well, don't they, for the time limit. I spoke to Tom Wielers at the finish, who was Kittel's lead-out man today in London, and I asked about, obviously, what Kittel was like as a leader. And he said that the main thing is his confidence that he can win these sprints. A little bit like Mark Cavendish in his pomp, even now, that he sort of infuses his team with confidence. But he also felt, you know, patting himself on the back and the team collectively on the back, that Kittel also draws a lot of confidence from the team, which is a very effective unit. They came to the front a lot earlier today, about 3.5-4 k's out, when they sort of hidden the bunch far longer on Saturday in Harrogate. And I asked about that, and he said it was because the roads were wet and they wanted to be at the front, stay out of trouble, take wider lines around the corners.
You talk about that confidence, Rich. I mean, one thing I've noticed with Kittel is that he doesn't obligatorily need to be on his lead-out man's wheel. I mean, for him, the role the team plays in the closing kilometres is more one of stringing the bunch out and keeping the pace very high and keeping it neat and tidy. But he doesn't necessarily have to be on his lead-out man's wheel. We saw that today. You know, we had the Giant Shimano team in a nice, neat line, but Kittel was actually separated from them for a while, but obviously didn't panic. Again, made good decisions, as we've been saying. At the moment, he's so confident that he seems to make the right decisions at the right time, all of the time.
Well, this seems to be the perfect time, actually, to hear from Cohen de Court, one of the members of the Giant Shimano team and a key man in the lead-out. I spoke to him after the stage here in London today and asked him to run through the whole of the Giant Shimano team and just explain who does what in preparing the sprint, controlling the bunch, and then doing the lead-out. But if you detect a bit of an Aussie twang to Cohen de Court's accent, that's because his girlfriend is Australian. He spends most of his winters there winding down and training for the new season. So this is Cohen de Court on the Giant Shimano lead-out train.
We've all got our specific roles on the team. We've got a couple of the guys that have to ride the front just to make sure that the breakaway doesn't go too far away. We've got mainly Cheng, our Chinese teammate, for that. But there's another couple of guys that can do the same role as well.
One of those is Dries de Venins, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. Dries is one of these guys that can ride the front also when it gets a little bit harder. So he's very valuable in that as well. Then we've got Tom Dumoulin, who kind of brings the train into position. So he rides in the wind for a very long time, tries to make sure that we don't have to spend any energy and still stay in the front. Then Albert Timmer usually starts to really get us to the front of the race, and usually does about the first turn on the front. And then after that, we've got Roy Curvis, who is also our road captain. He tells everyone where to go and where to be.
Is he very loud, very Sergeant Major style? Does he shout out the orders?
Actually, no, he's not. But he's I think, a very natural leader, and everybody listens when he's talking. So I don't think he has to shout too loud. I mean, a little bit more here is, you know, it's so loud on the side of the road. Yeah, he needs to shout a little bit louder. But in general, he's not a very loud guy, but he's definitely a leader. And then after that, we now had John Degenkolb do a monster turn on the front. That was really, really impressive. And then it was my turn after that. I had to guide the team through the last two corners and then sort of accelerate out of the corner and swing off for Tom Velas to do the final lead out this time. It was a little bit different 2 days ago. Then I was the guy that did the last turn on the front, but we swapped it around for a fast finish, because Tom is a very fast sprinter himself, and I'm more of a strong sprinter, so we turned it around that way. And then Marcel's the last guy to go.
Just a couple of things. First of all, there was only a very small break of two riders. They went very early in the stage without very much resistance from the peloton. Why was that, and did that suit your team perfectly?
It did obviously suit our team perfectly, because it means you don't have to chase that hard, and it keeps it fairly quiet in the peloton. But it's understandable that no one else really wanted to be in the breakaway, because there's nothing really to gain. I mean, the other 2 days there was at least a polka dot jersey to gain. Now that was sorted. I mean, there's an intermediate sprint, but there's nothing really to win there, because it's just points for the green jersey, so the breakaway doesn't really win anything there. So all that the breakaway can get is TV time, and a lot of guys just prefer to save some energy and try to spend that at days that it really counts. So that way it's easy.
With John Degenkolb being such a fast sprinter in his own right, some people might be surprised that he is in the fourth place in the lead out train and not the last man before Marcel. Why does that work?
It's being a lead out man is something completely different to being a sprinter. I don't think a lot of sprinters are very good lead out men. The case is that that it's a very specific role that you have to do. You really have to take care of someone else. It's like driving around with a trailer, and you need to make sure that that guy is still following you, and you can't just go through gaps, because you need to make sure that someone behind you can still fit through as well. And that way, I think it's better to put him somewhere where he can really use his power and just his speed as well, but a little bit further in front, where it's not as important that you guide someone through the peloton.
And very last question then, Marcel Kittel, how good is he compared to, say, Mark Cavendish and the other sprinters we've seen? There doesn't seem to be a huge challenge to him today. He was so far clear. That's partly the job that you guys did to get him in that position, but then he has the horsepower to finish it off.
Yes, he's incredibly strong. I mean, last year he was very strong and he won four stages, but it seems that he's even better this year. And when you see him sprinting, it's almost incredible. It's like he just attacks. So I hope he can keep it up.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freib.
Here we are, part two of the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at @cycling_podcast. We also have a website, thecyclingpodcast.com, and we are blogging daily. You can also find all our podcasts there. We actually passed 1 million listens today since we began this podcast a little over a year ago, just before the 2013 Tour de France. So thank you very much to everybody who's listened. It looks very nice, doesn't it, on the page, 1 million listeners.
If only we had a listener for every spectator in Yorkshire, eh, Rich?
Oh my goodness. We'll get there eventually, Daniel. We'll get there eventually. Let's tie up a few loose ends from today's Stage 3, reflect on our few days here. We're going to keep this a fairly shortish podcast, because we've got to somehow get to France through a tunnel that's apparently blocked. So we don't know how we're going to do that, but we're going to go and figure it out in a moment or two. We also are aware that we want to keep the podcast below 40 minutes if we can, because we realise it's a lot of listening, a big commitment that people are making. So let's not waffle too much longer. Any more loose ends from today? Mark Renshaw was third, Peter Sagan was second. Peter Sagan, I mean, what a talent. He's sort of, I mean, 2 years ago he won three stages at the Tour. He won one stage last year. But at some point, you're going to have to say the palmarès does not match the talent, does it?
Yeah. The difficulty is he's not a pure sprinter, is he, Peter Sagan? So we can't really expect him to beat Mark Cavendish at his best or Marcel Kittel at his best. But so he only really comes into play when the stages are a little bit harder and the real big sprinters get dropped. But if he comes to the finish on one of those days when Kittel doesn't make it over a final climb, he's going to be the shoo-in to win, isn't he? But you're right, he's not racking up the victories at the rate that his ability would suggest.
Or,
but that's because
in general, I mean, I wonder how he feels about that, whether that's a frustration for him, because he was up there on Sunday as well. He can win in almost any terrain, almost, but he's so fantastically good at all these things and not absolutely the best in the world at any one particular.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, I said yesterday that I think he'd made a major mistake yesterday, and I stand by that, by basically showing his cards too early, sort of too emphatically on that final climb on Jenkin Road. He was very, very strong, and we heard on French television Laurent Jalabert say earlier in the stage that he thought that Sagan was hanging on. Well, that was an ideal position for Sagan to be in, just making everyone believe that he was actually struggling. Later in the stage, he really came to the fore, looked very, very strong, was marking all of the moves, and at that point everyone just says, well, there's no way that I'm going to mark any moves for Peter, even if it just means dragging Peter Sagan to the finish. So he's got a bit to learn, I think, in terms of kind of racecraft and how to get the best use of his, as we've said many times before, fantastic repertoire of different skills.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a similarity to the way that Fabian Cancellara went through a phase in the Spring Classics of being so strong, so confident in his own ability, that he thought he could drop people or he could just ride away from them at any moment that he chose. And of course, that, as we did say yesterday, it lights up a rider like a Belisha beacon. It basically says, mark me, follow me, watch what I do. And that's exactly what happened to Sagan in the run into Sheffield. But he's up there in a flat sprint, flat out sprint. He's going to win the green jersey. If he reaches Paris, he's going to win the green jersey without much of a much opposition.
I
would have thought
he's won the green jersey already, has he not?
Well, no, you talked there, you made the comparison with Cancellara at Lionel. I think what distinguishes them from the majority of their rivals is that they're guys who have got multiple bullets. Particularly in cycling these days, we see that guys can generally launch one attack and then they go over their threshold and into the red and struggle to recover. Sagan, we saw yesterday, over the Jenkin Road climb, he went once, twice, three times marking moves. And
I thought you were going to break into a Lionel Richie song there.
Once, twice, three times a lady.
Yeah.
Is that Lionel Richie? Of course it is.
Yeah.
Wow, what a perfect ending to my contribution to this debate.
Well, I think you can contribute a little further because we've been asked by a few people on Twitter what's happening with Chris Horner, the 2013 Vuelta España champion. He's here. He's one of the three 40-plus-year-olds in the race. And is he here to contend for the overall or go for a stage, or is he perhaps targeting the white jersey as best young rider? I just don't know. Daniel,
there should be a grey jersey, shouldn't there, now for over 40s. I mean, this must be a record, 340-somethings in the race.
Certainly in the modern times, yeah. Mm. I think in the early part of the 20th century, the riders would have been some older riders. But
why not an old rider's jersey over 35s? Why not?
It's a good idea, but I would think that they would probably say that it doesn't really fit the kind of image of the sport. I think it might be a hard sell to the sponsors, maybe. I don't know.
Who would sponsor it, I wonder?
Saga Holidays?
All sorts of possibilities. Daniel, Chris Horner.
Yes, Chris Horner. So he struggled. He had some problems on the first day. He was dropped for a while. We weren't quite sure why that was initially. Today I spoke to Brent Copeland, who is a South African team manager of Lampre Merida. I should point out that towards the end of my conversation with Brent, we were interrupted by a gentleman, a very swarthy, we'll use that word again, Richard, swarthy but silver-haired, to continue with the theme that we introduced a minute ago, gentleman, and I turned around, and it was none other than Jose Mourinho. Shook Brent's hand, shook my hand, which I kind of regretted shortly afterwards. But previously, Brent had explained to me both Horner's struggles on the first day, also the role he's like to have later in the race, and we also talked a little bit about Sascha Modolo, who obviously was Lampre's sprinter coming into this race, had a horrific first experience of the Tour de France, was dropped on the first day and pulled out yesterday, and was effectively denied the opportunity to sprint for victory today on a finish line that he'd ridden well before. He came second in the Olympic test event to Mark Cavendish.
First stage he crashed, well, didn't really crash, he just went into the back of someone on one of the climbs that bottlenecked. Then he got going again, there was a bit of a gap, got back in. When he got back in, another climb bottlenecked, dropped his chain. By the time he put his chain on, got to the top, there was another gap, and that's when that gap of 30 seconds grew to a minute and a half. But we had two guys there to help him out with Oliveira and Chipolai, so they got back in. It wasn't much of a problem. Yesterday we were pretty satisfied with his ride because he's not really that kind of a rider that's punchy on those kind of climbs. So to finish 15 seconds behind was good. We were pleased with that. He's pleased with it. The thing that's good for us is he's only got margin of improvement as far as we're concerned because he hasn't raced much this year. He's only really trained, so he can only get better in the next few weeks. Just got to get through these first few days until the Ironberg without any problems, accidents or anything. And hopefully the first time he'll be able to show himself.
In relation to the GC, I mean, is he going to have some freedom or is he there to work for Rui?
At the moment he's there to work for Rui. Obviously on the 10th stage we'll know exactly what's happening in GC.
Yeah.
We hope to have two cards up there to play with the two of them. So at the moment, his role is to look after Rui, but we'll see how Rui goes, obviously.
And just on Sascha Modolo, you lost a man yesterday. Pretty horrible first experience of the Tour de France for him, the first 2 days. Can you just tell us what happened with Sascha?
So that was a pity, especially for today's stage. We were really hoping for him to do well on today's sprint, but he said that he had a bit of a stomach problem on the first day. We thought it was maybe just nerves or tension. He's a bit emotional doing his first Tour de France, obviously it's huge. Then yesterday it seemed worse and he had a bit of a fever in the morning. According to the doctor, he's picked up some kind of virus. So he said he had sore arms, he had a sore head, dizzy head. His fever wasn't too bad when he stopped, but he had 35 minutes with 30 k's to go, so he wasn't going to make it. There were so many people at the back there on his own, it was just a bit crazy and dangerous. So it was unfortunate because, yeah, with his form that he had the Tour of Switzerland, we really didn't expect him to go like that. But, you know, if you get sick, there's not much you can do about it. But he got a taste of what his first Tour de France is like. I think he realised that the next one he comes to, he's got to be 100% concentrated into it. So.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So we heard there from Brent Copeland. Daniel, what does he know Jose Mourinho, the Chelsea football manager, I should point out? Does Mourinho know him? Is that why he interrupted your conversation, or does he know you?
I'm not actually sure whether I was the bigger attraction there and why he actually came to speak to us at that moment, but I suspect that he knows Rui Costa, who's the world champion, who's Portuguese, rides for Lampre Merida. Another possibility, Rich, is that his antenna were twitching at that time because we'd actually started talking about Pippo Pozzato off the record, I must admit.
Anything to tell us about Pippo Pozzato?
Well, it's not looking good between Lampre and Pippo. I'll leave it at that, I think.
Maybe can we put a message on the podcast to Pippo to answer his phone, respond to text messages?
Well, Jose Mourinho was allowed on the Lampre bus, and I'm not sure Pippo Pozzato gets permission to jump aboard the Lampre bus anymore.
What kind of cycling team would Jose Mourinho run, Lionel?
Well, he would be an exponent of Catenaccio cycling. It would be very defensive. It would be... there would be an awful lot of control. There would be... They'd basically be sort of Sky-esque in Wiggins 2012, just all on the front, all looking kind of menacing in dark blue and black. A sort of reverse of the Sky jersey, I think. Jose Mourinho's would be his choice, I think. And
kids are chucking themselves to the road.
Yeah, and I think if there was any sort of controversy up at the front of the bunch with any of his riders, you'd expect Mourinho to drive right through the centre of the bunch to get up to the front and have a word with the chief commissaire, Fabian Cancellara.
Yeah. And gesture wildly like Mark Madio.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Let's reintroduce a very popular little item that we had last year, for which we need to hear from our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Lionel, any Pedaleur de Charme today? Who's your Pedaleur de Charme?
I'll nominate John Degenkolb, who was very entertaining after the finish line with all sorts of tricks. I don't know, skids, wheelies, whatever the kids do these days on their BMXs after the finish line, and was generally in a very chipper mood, as you would expect, having led Marcel Kittel towards his second stage win of the Tour.
Lionel?
Well, this is tricky. What, just for today or for the opening weekend?
We can make it for the opening weekend since we've not done it so far.
Lionel, if you want a moment to think about that, just to add something on John Degenkolb, I'm led to believe that on his recce of the Yorkshire stages, he was absolutely fascinated by dry stone walls and how they were built. And this was pretty much all he was interested in for the duration of the 48 hours he spent in Yorkshire. Every time they encountered a dry stone wall, he had to start. I'm not sure who they did the record with, perhaps Gary Verity, who was sort of Mr. Tour de France in Yorkshire, and he had to just stop and check that he'd got it exactly right about how they were made. He couldn't quite believe it.
Incredible stuff. Incredible. I'm not quite sure where to go from there. I would say, can I nominate Pedaleur Sans Charme, which is the anti-Pedaleur de Charme? Yeah. And it's only something that I saw on the internet, and it's one of the, you know, the Tour de France now is happening under such a microscope.
Stay off the internet, Lionel.
Yeah, thanks. there was a clip that emerged that somebody had taken of Ramanos Navadauskas of the Garmin Sharp team sort of slapping a camera out of a spectator's hand on one of the climbs. I think it must have been Sunday stage in Yorkshire. And obviously the riders were extremely tense both days. I think probably yesterday Sunday even more so than they were on the opening day, because the crowds were enormous. They were mountain stage style crowds, and Navadauskas obviously had had enough. And I can see both sides of this, because the riders were, you know, right on the limit of you know, tension from start to finish. It is very rare. In fact, it took me back to the rollout stage in Rotterdam in 2010, where the crowds were so huge in the first 40, 50 kilometres before they got to the Belgian border, that they were closing in to the width of a car on really quite wide roads, and there were tempers frayed that day as well. So I can see why he may well have lashed out, but it doesn't give a great image of cycling to see that, because now these things do get captured by somebody, and then they're on the internet, and then that was on the Yahoo News homepage, which is going to have a huge audience, isn't it? So
Navadauskas living up to his name as the Honey Badger.
Indeed, indeed.
Very fierce animals, aren't they, honey badgers?
They're known to slap cameras out of people's hands. That's what they're famous for.
Very shy animals, the honey badgers, right. Then, obviously.
And stand down cobras. It's because you have Ricardo Rico, isn't there?
Anyway, another nomination, a multiple pedaleur de charme. We've got to nominate the people who were out in Yorkshire making it such a memorable Grand Depart. Surely, every single person is a... an honorary pedaleur de charme.
Sure, we can do that. That should just cap a wonderful weekend for you, getting the pedaleur de charme collective award, all of you. I'll go for Brian Cockar, the young sprinter Europe car, who's fourth on Monday stage.
I spoke to him after the finish. He's a very I hesitate to use the word spunky, but he is a very entertaining young man.
Really?
Loves
Why?
Talking to the media. He's obviously thrilled to be doing his first Tour de France, and really, really believes in himself. In Harrogate, after the first stage, he felt that he could have won that stage today as well. He was very, very pleased with the lead out he'd got from Kevin Razor. And in fourth place, but I think he might come quite close to a stage win at some point in the race.
He's getting close. He's certainly outshining Arnaud Démare. A lot was expected of Démare, the French champion. He won here in the Mall actually last year in the London Surrey Classic, but he was down in 14th today. Maybe had a bad run in, but we expected a bit more of Démare, I think.
Yeah, I did as well, and I think they've struggled sometimes to position him. Today I think we saw Michael Delage, who is one of his key sort of lieutenants, kind of struggling around 1.2, 1.3 kilometres to go to get Démare into a decent position. He's had a couple of problems with, I think he's had an arm injury yesterday, I think he had a wrist injury. But I expect him to come to the fore on the fifth stage over the pavé. I mean, on paper, you looked at the tour route and you would have said that if there was an argument to pick Arnaud Démare over Nasser Bouhanni, we know that it was really for political reasons, because Bouhanni's leaving next year, whereas Démare is staying at FDJ. But from a purely technical point of view, I think that Démare has a good chance in that stage, and that was one reason for Marc Madiot to pick him.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Okay, let's wrap this up, fellas, because we need to get on the road and we'll be back in France tomorrow. So, a few other little items of business. Dave Brailsford was in L'Equipe today, Monday, an interview with Dave Brailsford where he was quoted as saying that he would like to win the Tour de France with a French rider. It's interesting. He did actually shoot that down in flames a little bit at the end of the stage. He distance himself a little bit from those quotes. He said he was speaking more in a general sense, that it's wonderful. He equated it to a British tennis player winning Wimbledon. It's always wonderful when a homegrown player, rider, wins that country's marquee event. But I just wonder, you know, he is a bit of a Francophile, isn't he, Brailsford? He spent years of some of his teen years in France. He travelled to France every year with his father, who now lives in France. He's a climber in France.
Well, he said on the podcast before, when he was racing as a young man in France. He lived not far from Badoit, and he'd fill up his bidons from the spring
with
there.
The sparkling water, the sparkling Badoit.
That's right.
He is it. I mean, is it true? The rumor. I really hesitate to share any rumors on this podcast after having my fingers burned in the past. But it's true that Warren Barguil might be on his way to Sky. Is that just a rumor, Daniel?
No, I think he will. He will leave the team that he's at the moment. Giant Shimano, and they obviously have problems to do with securing a sponsor for next year. I'm led to believe that Giant have pretty much guaranteed their commitment to a level which will allow the team to go forward, but they're looking for a co-sponsor. But Barguil will leave, I'm pretty sure. He has been sort of separated from his coach, who is also Thibaut Pinot's brother, Julien Pinot. They have worked together for a long time. Française des Jeux, FDJ, put their foot down at the start of the year and said, "And we don't want Julien working with other riders." So that was one slight bone of contention. And it's not been a wasted year for Barguil, but he certainly hasn't kicked on to the extent that we expected. He's still got the Vuelta ahead of him. And I think Brailsford is a big admirer. If you look at, you know, the kind of capacities required to win a Tour de France, Barguil is a very good climber, not yet a particularly good time trialist, but he has the physique for it. He's quite a tall guy, quite a sturdy physique, so there's a lot there to work with, but he's a long, long way off at the moment.
I mean, Brailsford was interested in Pinot as well. I mean, I think they tried to sign Pinot, didn't they?
Yeah, he's a long time admirer of Thibaut Pinot, and again, Pinot has fantastic ability as a kind of diesel in the mountains. He reminds me a little bit of Ivan Basso, can go for sort of 30-40 minutes on, so fairly long climbs at a very high pace. Struggles at the moment a little bit with accelerations, but really struggles with sort of racecraft. And, you know, I spoke to Julien, his brother, today, and he said he's really had a hard time these first 3 days, particularly the stages in Yorkshire, just because it's been so, so stressful. And time trialing, although it's improving, is still a bit of an Achilles heel as well.
So someone on Twitter today, we'll finish this up in a minute, but somebody on Twitter today asked if we would be able to interview Bernard Rees for this podcast. We will interview Bernard Rees, I'm sure. At some point, I can think of lots of questions to ask him about the team, about his relationship with Oleg Tinkoff and his relationship with Alberto Contador, etc., and the team's approach to this race. But feel free to tweet us if there's anybody else you would like us to seek out and interview, anybody you want to hear from. It's kind of a prerequisite that they speak English. I tried to interview Joaquim Rodriguez today after the stage, but his English wasn't really up to it. He speaks Spanish and Italian very well. So that's a bit of a prerequisite for the podcast, obviously. But Rodriguez, actually, anyone know what's really happened with Rodriguez? We're going to try and find out, because he's come into this tour having crashed out the Giro, but his head doesn't really seem to be in it so far. So he said that he's going to be hunting for stage wins in the final week.
Speculation only, but I did mention this in the pre-tour blog, our little questionnaire, who do you think will win the King of the Mountains, and I thought Rodriguez, because he's not in the shape to contend overall. Even if he was, what's his limit? It's going to be 4th, 5th, 6th, something around that region in the Tour de France. So stage wins and perhaps a tilt at the polka dot jersey, and if he can ride himself in, survive the cobbles, get through those couple of days in the Vosges, I think, you know, nice weather in the Alps and Pyrenees, we'll see him very active. But in order to have a role in the race in those stages, he needs to be out of the picture overall. So losing 10-15 minutes over the first weekend will probably work out pretty well for him.
Just on the King of the Mountains, one of the pre-race favourites for that jersey was Pierre Roland. He rode an extremely good Giro d'Italia, so good in fact, and he finished fourth, so good that I doubted whether he would have enough juice left for the Tour de France and to contend for that title. It was an objective. He said that he would go to the Giro to ride the overall, and he would come here to look for a stage and the King of the Mountains title. But on the evidence of the first three stages, he's still pretty fresh and could be a real threat on that competition.
Right, let's wrap up. I think we're all heading off. Daniel, you're heading off as well. Lionel, we're off to try and get through that tunnel. Wish us luck. And we'll speak to you again in France. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.